Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, the record low interest rates that we have are going to be with us for quite a while. The Reserve Bank seems to think that maybe it'll be 2023 before they're raised again. While that's good news if you're paying off a mortgage, of course, or debt, what does it mean if you've got cash that you want to invest or you're trying to realise on investments to keep yourself going? Putting it in a term deposit might have been a good option years ago, nice and safe, and you get a return. These days, you'll not only not make much of a return, you may not even keep pace with inflation. At the moment, bank saving rates and bonds may, as I say, probably are generally behind inflation. And that means, of course, you're losing money in real terms. In general, some types of investments seem to perform better than others when interest rates are low. So for this hour of the program, we're talking about the ins and outs of investing in a low interest rate environment. To discuss this tonight and answer questions, we're joined by Scott Phillips, Chief Investment Officer at Motley Fool Australia. Scott, good evening to you and welcome to the program.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Great to have you with us too. Also joining us is David Bassanese, Chief Economist at Beta Shares. David, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Can we start off with some general, I suppose, economic survey questions? David, why is the Reserve Bank's cash rate at a record low of 0.1%? And why are they saying with such confidence that it's never going to go up for at least 2 years?
Well, look, it really all comes down to the labour market, Philip. Basically, we have a situation where unemployment today is still a lot higher than the RBA thinks is full employment. So it's around about 5.8%. It did get as high as 7.5% during the COVID shock of last year. We did think briefly that it would get as high as 10%. But basically, it's still, and the RBA has this inflation target. It wants to get inflation at 2 to 3%, still below 2, and it thinks the way to get it up there is to get wages growth up. Mm-hmm. And the way to get wages growth up is to get the unemployment rate down and have a very tight labour market so we'll have better bargaining power with our employers out there. And the way to do that is to have very low rates because they think that will help stimulate growth and get unemployment rate down. So until such time as the unemployment rates get low enough that wages growth pick up, they're saying at this stage at least that they're going to keep rates very low. And so that's why we are where we are.
Scott, I mean, they've been saying this for several years now. I mean, wage rates have not gone up, so clearly it's not working.
And I think that is the big question.
Why don't they consider changing tack? What's that old adage that Einstein had? If you keep doing the same definition of insanity and all that,
doing the same thing, expecting a different result, bang on. And that is the real concern. I think the challenge for the RBA is rates are now at, as you've said, 0.1%.
They're basically zero.
If they're going to change tack, where does the RBA go? And I think that opens up a whole lot more questions about who should be doing it, what should they be doing? Is it the federal government? Is it fiscal policy rather than interest rates that are more important? Because once you're close enough to zero, you can go negative, and that's a whole different Pandora's box. Short of that, the RBA's not got a whole lot left. They're playing with bond buying. They're playing around with other things. But realistically, if they're going to make a change, if they're going to get this wage inflation up, as David said, they've got to find a way to do it. And the RBA, I think, are pretty close to out of ammo.
What's the whole 2023 target, David? You never used to have the RBA saying this. I mean, the RBA would be, lip-stitched from month to month. You'd never get a thing out of them. And now they're saying, hey, don't worry. But they're giving predictions out for 2 years. I mean, what's gone on?
Well, it gets back to the fact that, I mean, as mentioned, the interest rates are already at rock bottom. They can't cut the cash rate any further. But what they can do is try to lower longer-term interest rates. So, like, not the cash rate itself is like a very short-term interest rate. Mm-hmm. But if they promise to keep rates low for a long time, the market itself lowers longer-term rates, which is what corporates borrow at, like 2 to 3 year rates. And so that promise, if you like, at the moment helps to keep longer-term interest rates down as well. So they're trying to do two things: not only cut the cash rate, because again they can't cut it anymore, but they're promising to keep it low enough that the longer-term rates that corporates borrow at can also be quite low. And so that's why they're making that promise. You're right.
So therefore, corporates will borrow money, they'll invest, they'll employ more people, wages will pick up because more people are getting employed.
That's the idea. That's the idea, exactly.
Mm.
I mean, not only that, I just point out that they not only cut the cash rate to 0.1%, they're actually promising to keep the, I don't want to get too technical here, but the three-year bond rate, the rate that the government borrows on a three-year basis, they are targeting that at 0.1%. So they're actually targeting three-year bonds for governments at a very low rate as well, which in turn lowers the borrowing costs that corporations have to borrow at 3 years as well. So they're doing a few other things in the market at the same time.
Mm. Okay, all right. Well, that's what the RBA is doing. So we've got a low interest rate environment for at least 2 years. It may be longer. We don't know. And it must be said, before we start pointing the finger at the RBA, it doesn't seem any central bank in the West has solved the problem of what we have, which is low to negative wage growth in the economy, and the inequality gaps between those who own assets and those who don't seem to be widening. Can we talk about investing then, Scott? Do low interest rates make people more inclined to take riskier investments?
Yes, they do. And that's exactly what the RBA knows this is supposed to do. Whether it's businesses, as David said, or individuals, if you can't simply put your money in the bank, you've got to go somewhere else for a higher return. And that's exactly what we're talking about over the next hour, is where do you go as an individual investor to try and get something? I'm old enough, when I started putting money in the state bank account a million years ago, I was getting 6% and 7% at call. That wasn't even a term deposit rate. Honestly, I think it's partly why I'm doing this job. When you start with that sort of experience, you think, wow, how good is this? You make, you know, put money in the bank, you make 6% or 7%, you're doing really well. If you crack 2.5% of term deposit these days, you're doing incredibly well. And as you said in the opener, if inflation does pick up, which the RBA is actually targeting, you will start going behind. And I think that's the big risk. That's what they're trying to get us to do, is to take more risk. Now, that, unfortunately, for some people, think about if you're in retirement, if you're worried about where the next bill is going to get paid.
What about if you're approaching retirement? You're thinking, look, you know, I'm in the next 5 years, that's my plan, is to retire. You don't want risk.
Correct. And you don't have a choice right now, because now I do think, we can get into this a bit later, you can take a bit more risk as you get towards retirement, because retirement's a long time. We used to think retirement was 65, everything drops dead. That's the stop point. Most people live now to 85 or maybe even 90. You're possibly going to be retired almost as long as you're working. So we shouldn't see it only as the end point. But you're right, people start to think about, hang on, I can't earn anymore. All I've got now is what I've got. I can't afford to lose it. I don't want to be taking risk. And I don't blame people for being worried, given you can't get much in cash in the bank.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that's right. That even if you think, okay, well, you know, my retirement's likely to last 15 or 20 years, but I don't want to be losing money.
Correct.
Because I can't earn any more.
You don't want to get back at 75 or 77 and have to go and fill the piggy bank up again. Exactly,
because I won't have any capacity to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Scott, people talk about a diversified portfolio. Oh, sorry, David. People talk about a diversified portfolio, but in essence, this means a more risky portfolio, doesn't it, in this environment?
Well, we are. I guess investors are. There's a double problem for investors at the moment. So, a diversified portfolio is basically something that involves equities, as we know, like shares and bonds. And the thing about bonds at the moment, bonds are less volatile. They don't jump around in value as much. And they give you a regular income stream. But I guess the problem with bonds at the moment is that yields are so low that, and if they do go up a little bit in the next few years, as central banks eventually, you know, start to raise rates and the economy recovers and yields go up, the value of those bonds actually goes down. So not only are you getting a low starting interest rate when you hold bonds, fixed rate bonds, I'm talking about fixed rate bonds here, but the capital value of those bonds will actually go down as yields go up. Hmm. So it's not a great situation to be investing in, you know, longer term fixed rate bonds at the moment as a diversifier, because you're getting a low yield, and if yields go up, you get the benefit of them in the current situation is that if things go badly for the economy and equities collapse or go down in price, as we saw earlier this time last year, bonds do well. So that's that negative, as we say, again, not to get too technical, negative correlation. So when equities go down, bond values tend to go up. So you do get that offset. But the base case holding bonds today on a 3-year view or even a 5-year view, you're going to get a pretty low return for those bonds.
Okay. Scott, there's a phrase going around at the moment that cash is trash. Once upon a time, of course, cash was king, as I recall. And in fact, I suspect in the economy generally, cash still is king. But in the investment economy, investors are saying, look, you know, I don't know whether you should be holding cash because, after all, you know, you get nothing for it. What do you think?
I think that's roughly right. I think cash is king for the bills you have to pay. And I would say to people, don't invest anything in any other asset if you need that money in the next 3 to 5 years. If you've got to pay bills next year or the year after, if you've got to replace the car, replace the fridge, whatever you've got to do, you don't want to run the risk of having to sell shares at a cheap price. If we go through another, you know, correction like we had in March 2020, in a couple of years' time, you don't want to be selling at the bottom of that market. So cash is king to pay the bills. But cash is trash when it comes to earning a decent sort of return on your money. You're just not going to go, maybe you get bonds at almost nothing. Cash itself is literally nothing. I don't need to tell you or our listeners, if you think about cash in the bank right now in a transaction account, I'm getting nothing on that. I've got a, air quotes, high return savings account, which is giving me 0.5%. You cannot cover inflation. You can't make any money.
You're losing money at 0.5%.
You are, exactly. And that is why it's trash to some degree. It shouldn't have to be, potentially. The simple reality is, when rates are this low here and overseas, you've got to go somewhere to get a return to at least keep up with inflation. In theory, try and actually make some money, because that's why we're investing in the first place, not just to stand still. Cash is not going to do it for you. And that's unfortunate. You know, it's a terrible answer to have to give, because I wish there were options for people who didn't want to take that risk, but those options don't exist.
Here's a question I wanted to ask both of you, because it's come up a few times when we've had these discussions. I mean, one good aspect of low interest rates, of course, is that it's cheaper to pay off debt. And almost standard advice would be in the past, look, you know, if you've got debt, that might be a home loan or whatever, you should prioritize paying that off. However, if the debt's not costing you that much and you can get a better return somewhere else, are you better off actually, if you've got any spare cash, putting it somewhere else? Now, this question has arisen over superannuation, for example. You know, would people be better off in the current environment, given that your home, for example, a home loan is less than 3%, you can get better in that in most superannuation accounts. And when you retire, you can take the money out tax-free. In essence, are you better off putting the money into a super account rather than paying off your mortgage at a faster rate? I mean, obviously, you have to pay it off the minimum that you can. But are you better off, in a sense, this is not a theoretical question for a lot of people,
it's not,
putting it in a super fund and then saying, well, yeah, when I retire in 5 years or 6 years, I'll take it out tax-free. I'm after 65. I'll take it out tax-free, and then I'll just pay the home loan off. Then I'll have actually made some money. Whereas if I just pay the home loan, I don't know. Was that the best use of my money? Scott, what do you think?
Mathematically, it's a hard one. So we don't know what the future is going to look like, and so I'm going to have a lot of it depends answers right now. But the first thing is, on average, the stock market delivers about 10% a year. Super gives you about 6% a year on average. So yeah, the average year, you'll almost double the return you're getting in super, and as you say, tax-free, compared to paying off the mortgage. Mathematically, the odds are very good. You'll do better off putting it in super or just investing it in general rather than paying off or down the home loan. So that's mathematically. Behaviorally, what's really, really important is that we know ourselves. Because if I'm going to go and say, look, I'll take Scott's advice on the radio tonight, I'll go and do that. The market falls 10% in next month. They pull the money back out, say, that was stupid advice, I never should have done it. And they've locked in that 10% loss. So you've behaviorally, if you can do it, if you can see it through, and if you're happy to, frankly, take the chance that the odds may not play out, because averages are averages. We don't know what's going to happen next year or the year after specifically. But yes, mathematically, the odds are very good. You'll do much better putting it in super than paying off the home loan, as long as you're not putting yourself at financial risk by not having enough in that offset account or in that home loan account. If you lose your job, if you have bills to pay, it's always worth being safe and careful first and then maximizing returns after that.
What do you think, David, about this scenario?
Yeah, look, it's a tricky one, and I think Scott's answered as best one can. And the reality is, yeah, look, the long-run return from something like superannuation, given it has more of an equity exposure.
That's right.
Now, maybe equities don't deliver 10% a year going forward. It might be a bit less, maybe 8% or so, and bonds are going to be less. So think the overall return will be less, but it'll still be better than the mortgage rate.
Than the mortgage is costing you.
Exactly. And but, I mean, as Scott mentioned, what you don't want a situation where the equity market – what the problem with people that invest in the equity market is they – if the equity market falls 10% as it does, you know, every couple of years at least, or even 20% every, you know, 2 or 3 years – they take their money out at the bottom, and you've really got to be able to weather the storm and invest for that long term. So if you can stomach that volatility, that makes sense. If you can't, then the forced savings that you effectively are doing through your mortgage actually makes sense. So there's actually no one answer here. It really you know, goes back to your temperament and, you know, looking inside, you know, are you prepared to weather that volatility? And I get over five, and I just on this point, I mean, if it's a 5-year horizon, you probably don't want to do that because the probability is the market, you know, there is a chance the market does fall 20% or worse, and in which case you maybe, if you're retiring in 5 years, you maybe don't want to do all of that. But if it's a 20-year horizon, you know, I'm thinking younger investors here, you know, to like massively invest in their mortgage to pay it off as quickly as possible versus investing in the stock market at the moment. Maybe put some money in the stock market because you still got, you know, 30 years before you retire. So it's a different situation also. So really, you know, it depends on, you know, where you are in your investment cycle and your risk temperament, I guess.
But it's a live question though, isn't it? If you have some additional money which you could either put into your mortgage or you could put in the super. At the moment, it's a live question as to whether or not you probably should put it into super.
And I think if I could control that person's decision, say, but you may not take it out.
You can't take it out again, no.
Can't, if you freak out because the market falls, if I wave my magic wand and
well, if you put it into super, you can't.
You can change strategy. I mean, so people will, even inside super, go from conservative to growth to cash. And we saw so many people in the GFC in particular, we haven't got the data yet from COVID, but who bought in 2006-07, felt like they wanted to be part of the ride. 08-09, the market crashes. They sell everything, get out and say, I never should have done it in the first place. Then the market recovers and they miss both. So they bought high, they've sold low, they've sworn off the stock market, missed the recovery. You're kind of tripling up the damage.
Well, it's true that a lot of people inside super funds too, that's right, did make an investment switch, didn't they, and put it all in cash.
Absolutely. At exactly the wrong times.
If I can put,
you know, hold your hands by your side so you may not touch this, putting it in mid-super I think is perfect as long as you give it the time to play out. And it may take 7 or 10 years to David's point, but if it's in super, you don't have to take it out to pay off the house straight away, so you can give it that time. As long as you're disciplined. And we all think we are, right? We all think we're above average drivers, except we can't all be by definition. So you've got to know yourself, to David's point. You've got to know you won't do it. You'll do the right things. If I could literally control that sell decision for those people, I would say absolutely put it in super now. But if you know yourself better than I do, you know, if you're not going to do it responsibly, do yourself a favor, do me a favor, don't do it.
Just have some numbers we can use for this discussion tonight, David. So at the moment, deposit rates are under 1%. What are returns like on the share market over the past year or so, roughly?
Well, they've been fantastic. I mean, we've had look, the market, this is the, you know, if you invest in the share market, this is what you have to deal with. So in the COVID shock of last year, when we all went into lockdown, our market fell by 35% within a couple of months. It's more almost fully recovered that, not completely. So we've had like a 30, 40, you know, percent return since those lows. So net over a year, it's not been a high return, but it's been a lot of volatility over that period. So those that did invest at the bottom of the market last year have enjoyed, you know, spectacular returns, but that is the way of the market. And the past year itself has been one of the most volatile, you know, certainly in my career, and I've been in the markets for 20 odd years, and I've never seen anything like it. So you know, for the average investor out there to have gone through that, I mean, you know, I feel for you because it's tough for us in the industry as well.
Hmm. Yes, all right. Two investment experts with us tonight, David Bassanese, who you've just heard speaking, Chief Economist at Beta Shares, and Scott Phillips, Chief Investment Officer at Motley Fool. Taking some questions, if you've got them. We're talking about investing in a low interest rate environment. How do you get returns? Where should you go? And how much risk should you really bear, reasonably? Let's get to some calls. Warwick has got a question. Warwick, hello.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm asking about I've got sort of young adult kids and they're into the investing stage with a bit of money they've got from JobKeeper.
Yep.
Anyway, yep. Just a bit of fun. I put some money in crypto in January.
Oh, dear.
A bit more.
Yes.
And I'm up 40%. So far.
Yeah, I know.
I was going to discuss this
a bit later in the program, but okay, let's talk about it now because we had to get.
I look back on all the charts and all the coins I'm looking at, and all of them have gone up massively in the last 12 months, and I'm talking multiples.
Mm.
All of them.
Yeah, I know. So, have you looked back a year or so?
Well, it's a lot. There's a lot of money going in from institutional investors are starting to creep in there. Getting to a point where you got to think there's too many people who are going to lose if it falls over.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. Look, can we talk? Well, let's talk about it. Thanks for the question, Warwick, David, and Scott. Can I just put this thing to you first? It does seem to be attractive to young people for some reason. I mean, I think I probably know the reason why. But anyway, Scott, do you want to weigh in on this one?
Oh, this is tough, isn't it? Look, I think you ought to be very careful with cryptocurrencies. I think with any investment case, you've got to ask yourself, what do I think this is worth? What do I think it's worth more in future? And what is that actually based on?
Yeah.
And just because it's gone up in the past, just because Elon Musk is talking about it, just because, you know, X, Y, Z, pick your reason, as you say. The real concern here is I don't know how you value Bitcoin. I don't know how you work out whether it's worth more or less than last year or next year. And if you can't do that, it's speculation. At best, it's intelligent speculation if you want to draw a really long bow. Realistically, this is a whole lot of people punting on a whole lot of things that may or may not happen. Maybe it's fantastic, maybe it's not. If it goes well, I don't think you can claim too much credit for being right. If it goes badly, I don't think you can cop too much blame for being wrong, except that you played the game, you spun the roulette wheel, you choose your gambling analogy. This is, to me, pretty much straight out gambling, assuming that someone else will pay more for it at some future
point. It's straight out gambling, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Must
be. Warwick, your contention that because a lot of people have put money into it, it can't fail, is a proposition that I think's been tested and found wanting in the past, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I get your point, Philip, but I think part of actually what gives me a little bit of heart is actually because everyone over the age is very skeptical about it because they don't understand it. But people who are, you know, people who are into it, kind of get their head around it a little bit. And young people who are the people who are putting more and more money into this, I think it's going to kind of, I think about it today, you know, because young people always complain about they can't buy property, so they've missed out on this great upsurge and all that. I think that's going to be the flip around. There's going to be a whole bunch of old people who are going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. Look, I don't understand it. Terrible, it's gambling, I'm not going to go there, and they're going to miss out.
Okay, let's...
My final point, one quick final point.
Yeah.
I think it's the only finite thing in the world. And that's a proposition. Gold's not finite.
Why is it finite? There's about 200 other cryptocurrencies out there.
Yeah, if Bitcoin is concerned...
I'll come to you in a minute, then.
As I understand... It's finite. There's a finite amount of bitcoins that will be produced.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Warwick. I mean, hang on, Warwick. I mean, because David, weigh in on this one.
Oh, just a quick comment. I mean, I take Scott. I mean, it's very hard to. We've had bubbles in history, and I suspect this may be one of them. You know, if the Bitcoin itself could easily go a lot higher, but it could easily collapse. And I think one thing that tends to undo bubbles in the long run is supply. And Bitcoin may be finite in supply, but as you point out, there's a lot of other competing cryptocurrencies. And if Bitcoin goes to 100,000, let's say, there'd be a lot of other, you know, Dogecoin, you know, whatever, you name it, a lot of competing coins can come out. And that's what may eventually tip the balance. So again, I would just urge caution as well on these sort of things. I don't see it. An electronic currency makes sense. It doesn't make sense that it needs to skyrocket in value. I mean, the point of it is to be a stable medium of exchange. And something that goes up and down 20, 30% one month to another is not a stable medium of exchange. It actually doesn't make any sense in that regard.
Mm.
But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, good luck.
There used to be an old maxim, if you don't understand something, you shouldn't invest in it, isn't there? Do you think that's still true?
I think the challenge for that is that people understand, to Warwick's point, the technology behind it. That doesn't make it a good investment, right? So understanding what a business does or a currency might be, a cryptocurrency might be,
doesn't necessarily make it a good investment.
And that's the key point, right? So it's being able to value that. Is it finite? Yes. Do people actually care about the fact it's finite? Well, it depends, right? There's only so many Beanie Babies ever made and no one wants those anymore. Plenty of people want Picassos. Maybe you get it right, maybe you get it wrong. That's the point. That's why this is speculation. You simply can't know in 5 years' time, are we all talking about Bitcoin or is no one talking about Bitcoin? There's no way to know the answer to that, even given that finite nature.
Are there bubbles that it occurs to you, David, that have occurred like this in the past? I kind of think myself there are.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, the dot-com bubble 20 years ago.
The dot-com bubble was an example, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot, you know, if you go back to the 17th century, there was the red tulip bubble in Europe where everybody wanted to buy red tulips because they thought there was, repeat what was just said, limited supply. And then there was a massive influx of supply because everyone started growing tulips. I don't want to necessarily say this is a bubble, but I mean, I think, you know, and it could go higher in the short run, but definitely there is a history of bubbles and fads, then this could well be one of them.
Have you got any?
Me personally?
Yes.
No, I don't have any.
What about you, Scott?
I bought $100 worth of Bitcoin about 7 or 8 years ago just to have skin in the game to follow along with the story.
Okay.
I famously joked that I bought it with an app that I now can't sell it, so I've got some Bitcoin that I haven't been able to access since, and I'm okay with that. I don't know what it's done. It's probably done okay really in the last year or so, but it was just purely a token thing so I could follow along and just be part of the process.
As to the point that it's limited, that may be true in an absolute sense, although it's infinitely spliced at the moment,
correct,
isn't it? No one buys a Bitcoin because they cost too much. So the what you buy is a little bit of one.
Correct. And that's part of it. You know, again, it is speculation. Whether you're right or wrong, there is no fundamental basis. If you buy shares in Woolworths, pick a company, you can look at the business, you can make an assessment as to what its profits are, will it make more profit next year, how much are you paying for those profits? If it says someone, how are you pricing your Bitcoin right now? On what basis is it worth, what is it, $80,000 or something, whatever it is right now?
Mm.
On what basis are you assessing that value? You get the, well, it's finite. Well, it'll go up more because more people will buy it. Elon Musk loves it. But there's no fundamental basis of saying it is worth this because it's underpinned by X, Y, or Z.
Hmm.
And without that, it can only be, as I said, it can be intelligent speculation potentially. It can only ever be speculation. It's not investment.
Do you buy the idea that Warwick raised, David, that it's a young person's game? Young people understand this and there's something different about their view of the world than there is of your view of the world?
I'm not sure they necessarily understand it any more than anyone else. I mean, it's tech related. It's obviously that tech type of exposure is appealing to young people. But there's a lot of great technology exposures out there. You know, tech companies doing great businesses without being in crypto. But I can see why they appeal to it because it is new. It's and tech related.
Mm. Okay, John. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask a question about index funds.
Yep.
But I just want to make a quick point about cryptocurrencies. I think cryptocurrencies are one of the most anti-environment investments you can make because if you're involved in them, you're encouraging people to mine them, and the mining uses phenomenal amounts of electricity.
You mean because it has to power computers to find them? Hmm.
Yeah, I've read that... And this is going back at least a year, that all the mining of cryptocurrencies on computers adds up to the electricity consumption of all of Ireland.
Dean's texted me saying Bitcoin uses the equivalent of 20% of Australia's energy requirements to mine new Bitcoin. Well,
yeah, so it's very anti-environment. Question I want to ask about index funds.
I don't want to talk about Bitcoin all night, but go on. Yeah, go on.
With index funds, they seem to be a sort of prudent, sort of sensible investment in the stock market. but I'm having a bit of trouble finding one because, like, if you go back about 10, 15 years, it was very simple. There were very few, and they did a very simple thing. They would just track the whole of the ASX or maybe the ASX 200. Now there are so many, and like a lot of them are so specialised and so kind of niche. It almost seems like a contradiction in terms, you know, because the original idea seemed to be, you know, that you spread the risk by tracking all or a lot of the
ASX. You're talking about exchange-traded funds, are you? ETFs? Essentially, John.
Am I? Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, ETFs.
Is
yeah.
he, Scott? Yeah.
Yeah, John, you're right. Index fund was the old name, and you're right when you say that it used to be the case there was a couple out there, and they were exchange-traded, which is where we get the name exchange-traded funds from, and they were largely synonymous with index funds because there was a couple of them. They tracked the index, and that's why those terms become interchangeable. But as you're rightly saying, John, there are now many, many, many more, and so the new breed are the exchange-traded funds rather than index funds because they do track pretty much anything you want. In fact, in the US, and David can tell me more about this, there are actually more ETFs than there are individual companies listed on the US stock exchanges you can kind of create and rehash and recreate groups of companies. And I believe there are more ETFs than stocks on the US exchanges.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about this, and John, so keep listening, John. Your question might be answered too. David, to you too, because I wanted to have a quick discussion about ETFs. What do you think about them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love them. I mean, our business does ETFs. So basically, they are index funds. I mean, just to the caller's question, I mean, index funds per se, as Scott mentioned, do track the market. They're typically low-cost funds that track like the Australian stock market or the US market. Now, historically, they tended to be not available on the exchange. You had to fill out complicated application forms to get access to them. The big innovation with ETFs is you can buy them now through the share market, just as easily as a company's share. So that's the only difference. It's still an index fund, but you can just buy it as you would CBA or Woolworths or whatever.
Is it better to invest in an ETF that covers the whole market, or is it better to invest in an ETF that covers individual sectors? Or is this like how long's a piece of string type question?
Well, that again, just to go to the caller's point, if you just want it's up to what you want. The beauty of, I guess, if you just want an index fund that tracks the market, they're definitely available. In fact, you can get one now that charges 0.07%, 7 basis points.
Speak to John about that. John, is that what sort of thing you're after?
Yes, or I thought another fairly basic, straightforward one was something that tracks the ASX 200.
Exactly. There's many funds, you know, that do that. But just to the point about should you invest in it, again, but if you want to try to beat the market, this is where it comes down to. If you think you want to beat the market, like do better than the ASX, then there are opportunities to do that. You're not forced to do it. But if you think the technology sector in Australia is going to do better than the overall market or resources or banking, there is an ETF that tracks just that specific sector. And then, so it's really up to you. If you decide that's the way you want to go, you can do it. And, you know, the tech sector and the bank, you know, different times over time, those sectors have beaten the market. So it comes back to being an active investor if you want to. It's just another way of being an active investor to try to beat the market. But you're definitely not forced to do that. But we, you know, ETF providers, of which we are one, but there's many, offer those opportunities if you want to go down that path. But if you just want something very simple, they're definitely available.
Yeah, well, I'm not really so interested in beating the market. I mean, I'm trying to find an investment, you know, that would be the equivalent of 10 years ago, where I could get 8% for a term deposit. I want something that's fairly conservative. So maybe something like something that tracks the ASX 200 might be something that might be fairly conservative. Would you agree?
Well, it tracks them. I mean, the market itself will go up and down. As I said, last year it went down 35% and it's rebounded since. So if you're investing in the equity market, arguably it's not that conservative because the equity market itself is very volatile. But again, if you're holding it from a longer term perspective, 5-10 years, again, compared to, say, even investing in Woolworths, I mean, you invest in one company, you're taking a lot of risk in that company. The beauty of investing in an index fund that tracks the market, you're diversifying your exposure against 200 companies. So you're basically tracking something that invests in the Australian economy. And if you think the Australian economy is going to keep going up, then the share market over time will keep going up.
Yeah, I am thinking of something that I'd stick with for 5 or 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. All right, John. Well, anyway, their options are out there. And these days, as I say, they're called ETFs. What happens with dividends, David, in ETFs? Are they, do you get them or are they just reinvested in your fund?
No, they are part. I mean, as any managed fund, all the income that are received from the ETFs are passed through to investors. So you get a regular dividend payment depending on the ETF. It could be quarterly. Typically, it's quarterly, could be 6 monthly. You get a nice statement at the end of the year saying how much dividends you got, what the franking credits were. You obviously get the benefit of franking credits if the companies provide franking credits. And you can actually elect to reinvest those dividends. So if you actually don't want the dividends, you want to actually reinvest them into the fund itself, you can, you know, tick a box on a form and it can do that. But if you're investing in them for dividend, for income, they definitely deliver income over time as well.
All right. Is it simpler than investing in shares? I mean, is the paperwork simpler?
Well, once you've signed up for a share trading account, you know, be it for any one of the share trading platforms out there, it's as easy as buying a share. So you basically find the code of the ETF that you want to invest in.
Right.
And you just, so for example, if you're buying BHP, people that trade shares out there, you know, you type BHP into your share trading platform, you get BHP. If you you type in A200, you get our A200 ASX ETF that tracks the market. Okay. So that's the way it works.
That's the way it works. Okay. Had a couple of texts from Geraldton and Cal Barry. Sharon says, Phil, you might bag cash, but cash is crucial here in Geraldton. We've got no power, no ATMs, no FPOS. What shops are open only accept cash, and there are no fuel pumps working. I feel like a pioneer. Yeah, well, fair enough too. Yes, exactly. In a place with no electricity, there's nothing that's tradable other than cash, and probably your Bitcoin is not helping you much in those circumstances either, I suspect. Steve, hello. G'day, Steve. Sorry for waiting on.
That's okay. No, thanks very much. Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Appreciate the conversation. I don't want to make anyone repeat themselves about anything, but I just did have a question, and going on about what you were speaking about earlier was in regards to, so I own a home. I'm a homeowner, but paying off a mortgage. And I just am interested that if I was a, I want to know the best way to invest my money, any extra money that I have, because at the moment all I'm doing is just putting it on my home loan.
Yeah.
Now, I was interested about the kind of putting it on my super, because I'm only 40 years old, and, you know, down the track, I'm interested, you know, probably before I retire, I'm interested in doing some renovations on my home. But that might not be happening in the next 10 years. Or, you know, that won't be happening within the next 10 years. So I'm looking for a 10-year investment. Am I best to just put the money on my home loan and keep doing that? Or am I better off investing in something like a low-fee EFT for the next 10 years?
That's exactly what this conversation tonight's all about.
Exactly. So I was just curious about, you know, what do the guys think, you know?
Okay. Scott, can we start with you on that?
Yeah, Steve, I mean, we can't give you personal advice, obviously, so that's the first thing we should obviously say. It's a really tough one. So you mentioned, we've kind of mentioned it already tonight. The challenge for that is we can't know what the future looks like. And you know that cash in an offset account or cash paying down a mortgage is real money knocked off your account. It's there in black and white. You can't have it taken off you. So if it's that risk you want to avoid, if it's that experience you want to have, then that's right for you. We can't tell what's right for you behaviorally, what, again, is right for your circumstances. What I would say is, if you're asking me, on average, do I think money invested outside your home, i.e. in super, or frankly just in a diversified ETF, as you mentioned, I think that's very, very likely to beat the market and beat what you're going to get in the mortgage, over 10 years, certainly over 20 years. And so if you're asking me mathematically where I'd place my chips, I would absolutely be investing that money rather than paying it off the mortgage, as long as I said earlier, you're not going to put yourself in financial stress. If you lose your job, you've got some cash to fall back on, all the stuff that goes with that. So good financial hygiene, if you like, first. Once you've done that, once you're in a good place there, I'd be very, very, you could knock me over with a feather if money in a mortgage beats cash being invested in effectively almost anywhere else, but certainly in shares over the next 15, 20 years.
Mm. Okay, but sorry, can I just ask one question? So would you invest in an ETF as opposed to bonds at this stage if I was going to invest for 10 years?
Again, I can't see what you should do, so I need to be really, really careful. But yeah, I personally would. Yes, I think I think shares are almost, well, I can't say certainly either. I'd be very surprised, very, very surprised if shares don't beat bonds handily over a decade plus.
Mm. Yeah, look, just thanks, Steve. I mean, the reason we can't give personal advice is that it's against the law for us to do that. That's all. We're not being reluctant here.
No, sorry. Yes, thanks, Phil.
David, what your thoughts on that?
Look, one advantage of regularly investing in the share market is what you might be suggesting, like instead of regularly topping up the mortgage, investing is what's called dollar cost averaging. And when you face a situation of a volatile market, dollar cost averaging is where you invest a little bit regularly in the market. And the beauty of that is that if the market does fall, you're actually buying more exposure to the market as it falls. So over time, that sort of gradual investment in the market. So that's a difference from saying having a big pot of money now that you're going to plonk right into the share market on day one. If you're investing gradually over time, you know, actually it's a way of reducing your risk somewhat in the market as well. And just to Scott's point, I mean, if you look at the share market statistically over 10 years, there have been periods in time where you've got a negative return on the share market over 10 years. But it's been pretty rare. So again, we can make no promises, but all we can say in terms of historical evidence that the times in which you get a negative return by investing in the share market over 10 years is pretty rare. So that's not that's just a fact. That's just the empirical fact. And, obviously what happens going forward is another question, but that's what's been the history of the market.
Sure. All right, Steve, good luck with it. Thank you. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Gee, look how time is flying. And I do want to cover a couple, because what our conversation tonight is in a low interest rate environment, what should you do with your cash? I think we've decided don't put it in cash. We've discussed whether or not you should put it in super or pay off your mortgage, and we've had some interesting thoughts about that. Two other things. Can we dispose of bonds quite quickly? I mean, is there any point at all in investing in bonds at the moment, Scott?
I wouldn't. I think the orthodoxy says you should have some bonds in a diversified portfolio. I don't see the value. If you want to have some ready cash, keep it in cash for that 3 to 5 year bill paying, as I said.
Hmm.
Other than that, I don't see how bonds are adding to your investment returns,
David?
Over a longer period.
David, what do you think?
I do have a bit of a nuanced there is the fixed rate bonds. These are things that are basically, if the interest rates go up, the value of those bonds goes down. At the moment, they're not a great value proposition, but there is something called hybrids. These are like a form of a bond, and I won't get into the details of them, but basically they're offering you at the moment on average around about a 3.5% yield, which includes franking credits, so you do get the franking credits. Now the beauty of those is that they are much less volatile than equities. If equities sell off, the value of those do sell off, but not by as much. A little bit more correlated with the equity market than a traditional fixed rate bond, but the yield you're getting is attractive. And so hybrids is an interesting exposure, I think, somewhere in between the traditional bond and the equity. And again, you can get them through an ETF. So that's one way of getting a hybrid. But again, if you don't want to go all in with the share market, but accept cash and traditional bonds are pretty horrible in terms of return outlook, but something to consider, something in between the two.
Hmm. A couple of texters saying, thanks for explaining what an ETF is and how you actually get into one, but how do you find a good one? David?
How do you find a good one? Well, I mean, look, there's, you know, you can Google ETFs and a lot of ETF providers will come up. I mean, I don't want to necessarily promote
blow your own trumpet,
we do provide ETFs, so you can go to our website. We've got 60 funds available across all manner of asset classes and exposures. Now, what's a good one? Again, it comes back to the question before. If you want a low cost, something that tracks the market, that's available. If you want to sort of pick the eyes out of the market and pick a sector, you can do that as well. But again, we don't offer that.
Is there a comparison guide for what these ETFs are returning?
Well, you know, it's tricky because they basically track indices. So they're tracking different sectors. So it's, you know, I can tell you, like, over the last 10 years, global technology, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook have done really, really well. So if you could look at the historical return, you'd say, oh, I should invest in that. But does that necessarily mean they're going to do as well going forward? So the problem is that just because something's done well in the past doesn't mean it's going to do well in the future when you're talking about different sectors. So that's the problem. And again, I would warn people looking at index funds in that regard, don't necessarily just look at historic returns, because just because a sector or an industry has done well, it may well continue to do well, but there's no guarantee of that. So you really have to take a view on the sector or the market.
Ben on the text line, is it possible to invest in an ETF with $1,000?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it is.
And I would say, just to add to David's point, if you're getting started and you're looking for an ETF, grab a super low-cost broad index fund, ASX 200, ASX 300, US S&P 500, really simple, really easy, super low-cost, great way to get started. You can invest in some of these using some of the broker's own platforms for as little as $50 a trade, as in not the cost of the trade, literally investing $50 at a go. $1,000, absolutely you can get going for sure.
Okay. All right, forget bonds. Well, not forget bonds, with the rider that David had. Property, very briefly, because we do talk about a fair bit about property, Scott.
So I'm a shares guy, and I think that makes me jaundiced. I take whatever I say now with a pinch of salt. I don't see how the yields on investment property versus owner-occupied, right? Owner-occupied, buy your own house almost any time.
No, of course, but investing in property.
If you look at the rental yields and the elevated prices recently, if you think that's going to continue for an extended period of time, I don't see how that happens unless we get a wage explosion. We can't keep paying higher and higher proportions of our wage on mortgages. Now, we have been doing that for the last 5 or 10 years, right? So I've been wrong that long. I don't see how those returns are meaningfully larger in future. So I'd struggle to see a yield of 2-2.5% in capital cities, capital growth probably constrained over the medium to long term. I see why people want it, because it's easy. You can touch it, feel it, look at it. I wouldn't be buying it myself as an investment. I'd look elsewhere. And if you want to do property, maybe a real estate investment trust in shares, but I'd probably avoid that too.
What about you, David?
Yeah, look, I agree. I mean, I think over the next 6 months to possibly a year, you're going to see a pretty hot property market, but thereafter it's going to taper off. I mean, low interest rates are fueling asset price booms in the equity market and in the property market. But look, there are easier ways to get returns than dealing with tenants and, property upgrades and all that sort of stuff. So, I can see why people do it, because they understand it a bit more than the share market. But in this day where you can buy a low-cost fund that tracks the market and get a good dividend, for my money, it's a simpler way of getting a pretty decent return with less headaches, I think.
What about commodities? Gold and silver are actually traditional stores of value, as it were. They've had a pretty good year.
They have until recently. Gold's fallen off a cliff over the last 3 months or so, largely because the stock market's come back. So it's when people are fearful, they rush at commodities. When they're not anymore, they tend to abandon them and go back to shares. So to David's point, you talk about the negative correlation earlier on. Shares tend to go down and gold goes up and vice versa. Over time, though, shares outperform precious metals. So if you're owning them, you're owning them for a bit of volatility protection, but you're lowering your overall returns, would be my guess.
David?
Yeah, look, I'm not... Look, the long run trend in many commodity prices has been down, and that's really technology disruption and low inflation that we're seeing in the last few decades is undermining commodity prices. So, I as a long term investment, I think you can get a fairly low return. I mean, if you identify a particular commodity, something that's in lithium batteries or something like that. I mean, but as a general rule, I suspect gold will give you not a fantastic return. Again, because we're in a low inflation world. If inflation were to go back to the 1970s levels, those old enough to remember that period, I mean, gold will do very well. But if we're in a low inflation world, commodities generally won't do that well, I would suggest.
All right. If you're in a super fund, many of us are, many of your listeners would be, should you be increasing the risk profile of your super fund at the moment or keeping it balanced?
It depends on your age group. If you're getting closer to retirement, you want to be taking less risk because you want less volatility, as we talked about earlier. If you're earlier in your career and your life, I would be absolutely, if you can stand the volatility, because again, remember, higher returning asset classes tend to be much more volatile. So shares more volatile than cash. We've talked about the comparison there. I would absolutely increase my weighting to growth assets if I can stomach the volatility.
Okay, David, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, all else constant with your risk profile. I mean, at the moment, I think from a tactical point of view, equity is going to outperform bonds. Yep. We're in a global recovery phase that's going to last until unemployment rates get a lot lower than they are at the moment. So, again, from a tactical point of view, taking a risk profile into account and all that sort of stuff, this is a time where, you know, equities are more likely to outperform bonds than typically over time. Over time, they generally do, but this is a particular time where they're more likely to be able to do that. So, yes.
Okay. All right. Look, time has beaten us. Scott, there's quite a few people on the text line who are very sad about your Bitcoin that's trapped in your app.
I'm okay. I'm all right with that, but thank you.
A lot of people want to take it off your hands.
I bet they do.
They'll figure out how to work the app.
For a fee, I'm sure they will. I appreciate their concern.
At least it's not one of those people that had it in your computer and then you tipped your computer in the bin.
Exactly.
All right. Gentlemen, always terrific. Thank you for joining us. Scott Phillips is Chief Investment Officer at Motley Fool. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Philip.
And David Massanese, Chief Economist at Beta Shares. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Philip.
Terrific to have both of you gentlemen in. Thanks for the calls and texts. I hope you found some of that helpful.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.